Is there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
Welcome to our latest episode of Words to Write By.
Hello, everybody.
And today we are not reading a book.
We're doing something completely different. Well, not completely.
Mm-hmm. We are doing an interview episode, and the interview is with Eric Klass. And welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you. It's really great to be here. My name is Eric Harper Klass. I am a writer and editor. I live in Los Angeles. I've been writing for around 15 years or so. I've been editing for around 5 or 6 years or so. And a few years ago, I started a company called Submit It, not Submittable. We do editing, but most importantly, we do submissions. So writers send me their work, short stories, and creative nonfiction essays, and we help them find journals to send them to, and we do the actual submissions. So I know we'll talk more about that later, but that's kind of in a nutshell.
Excellent. So we run a process group, a bunch of writers get together, and one of the most common questions we get is, you know, I'm writing short stories, or I'm writing a creative essay, where can I submit it? And our general response is, well, there's this thing called Duotrope, and there's this thing called Submittable, and you go there and you find places that will accept and you send it in. But that's really like on the like very nitty gritty details. Like, how is the whole short story publishing industry work?
Yeah, I am a writer also. And so part of why I started Submit It is because the whole process is so miserable. So I've sort of gone through what I think everyone's gone through. I sort of feel like there's these two things that people do. The first thing is, okay, I have the greatest short story ever written. I'm ready to send it out. So here you go, New Yorker and The Atlantic. And I don't know, let's have a safety journal like the Missouri Review or New England Review or something. And we send out 4 or 5 stories and we wait around, you know, 6 months or 7 months or 8 months. And of course, they're all rejections because those journals accept about, you know, 0.00001% of the stories that they receive.
So I got a question here. So I'm trained as a journalist. And when I would query for a proposal for an article or something, I usually got a response within days or within a week. Journals take forever to get back.
Yeah.
What exactly do they do with your piece during that time?
I think they're just sitting in line somewhere. I mean, obviously it's virtual now, but it's the virtual slush pile. These top journals just get so much work, and they only have so many readers. And, you know, again, I'm on the submission side, not the journal side. So I don't know exactly what's happening, but this is part of the problem of only submitting to these top tier journals. They're just overwhelmed. And so you got to wait around. You know, one of the things I tell writers is make sure to have many pieces floating around in the journal world at once so that you're not sitting there waiting, you know, six months or longer before you decide to send something else out. And then at least then you're getting replies here and there. They're not all slow, but on average, they're pretty darn slow. And I think they're just overwhelmed with work.
Okay. So one other thing I was going to ask about is you use the term journal for these places.
Yeah.
And I think of them as magazines, although a lot of them are online as well.
Yeah.
Is there a distinction?
I don't think so. You know, if you could see my Google Ads advertising, it's like my keywords are literary journal, literary magazine, lit mag. Those are sort of the three that show up the most often. And the one that I've sort of embraced is literary journal. And if you look at the numbers, that's the one that seems to be searched for the most. But lit mag and literary magazine, they're all interchangeable. They're all synonyms.
And who exactly publishes lit journals? Literary journals?
A wide range. A number of the better ones are affiliated with universities, you know, like the Missouri Review. I hope I'm not wrong on this, is affiliated with the University of Missouri. So there's a lot of them like that. And then there's other ones like the New Yorker is published by the New Yorker. And there are sort of four, the New Yorker, Harper's, The Atlantic, and the Paris Review. I mean, I call them literary journals, but they do a lot more than that as well. That, you know, they have more reporting than a normal literary journal normally would. But then there's also journals that are run by a couple people that just publish, you know, like on a WordPress site or something like that. So there's really a huge range in terms of affiliations with universities and large mastheads and small mastheads and sort of everything in between.
Now, Renee, actually, when you worked at one of the community colleges, you guys published a journal, right?
Yeah, for a couple of them. At De Anza Community College out in Cupertino, it was Red Wheelbarrow, and I was on their staff. And then I was the head editor at the one at Evergreen Valley mm-hmm. College, which is called Leaf by Leaf.
Right. And I suppose that, like, you know, you never ask for submissions to Submittable or Duotrope.
We were small potatoes. I mean, well, we were mostly just only publishing people in the community college. It's, you know, mm-hmm. But, you know, when I was getting my MFA, it's a little bigger. There's like a whole class usually surrounded by the magazine, and then they get MFA students to edit them. And then, you know, they go up the editing ranks as they keep taking the class over and over again.
There are a lot like that too, kind of student run with faculty advisors. And I rate my journals. So one thing I'm trying to do is find journals that are going to be around. Journals come and go a lot. It's an ephemeral business, to say the least. But I'm trying to find ones that are going to be around years from now. And the journals that are affiliated with universities or run by universities do tend to stick around because they can afford to. I try to stay away from journals that have like a single person masthead. You know, somebody wakes up and says, hey, I think I want to start a journal. And they do a free, you know, blog post site somewhere and people email them their stories. And then a year later, this sucks. I think I'm going to close this one down. So there's a lot of those.
Okay. So here's a confession. While I've written a whole bunch of stories and I've submitted them to a bunch, I almost never read the journals that I submit to just because there's so many. And so my question is, who reads these things consistently?
Well, so I'm not sure. Clearly the bigger ones are read by writers who are interested. Mm-hmm. A smaller journal might be read by like friends or affiliates to the editors. You know, anytime I get published in a journal, I become interested in the journal and read the journal and also sort of like cross my fingers that I like what I'm reading, because otherwise, like, oh, what am I doing here? There's probably not as much readership as we'd all like to believe, at least in the smaller journals. So I don't know if we're trying to get published in journals necessarily to get tons of people reading our work. I think there's other reasons to do it. Part of my job is every weekend I sit and read short stories from journals that nobody's ever heard of, because it's part of what I do for Submit It. But, you know, I'm obviously an oddball in that sense.
You're not keeping them afloat.
Yeah, for sure. But there are readers. With the work that I've published, I do occasionally get somebody to say, hey, I read your piece here and it was great. And that's like one of the pleasures of doing this. And, you know, I don't reply, really? You read my work? You know, it's like, thank you for reading it. So, you know, and clearly, again, the stronger journals, the bigger journals, the ones that have been around longer are going to have a larger readership. And if you ever get published in one of the top, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 journals, then you're absolutely going to get people reading your work, because people do read those journals in the same way that people read any periodical. So I hope there's readers.
You know, I used to assign them sometimes, and then that would get them guaranteed 30 copies sold.
For sure.
For my students. And, you know, and it gives them that realistic notion of what publishing actually is, you know, because there's that agent in the sky and that huge, you know, HarperCollins or Penguin. And we get people in process group not realizing that there's this whole other world in the writing community that is the small press.
Yeah. And by the way, I was a musician for about 15 years before I became a writer. And I considered it part of my job to really know what was going on sort of underneath the top commercial layer. and I would force myself to listen to like college radio and in music, you can go out and actually hear music. And I wanted to know what was happening underground a little bit, because I do think that that underground layer is where the interesting new stuff happens. And I think with writing, if you're only reading, you know, books on the New York Times bestseller list, or you're only reading the top 10 literary journals, or what a lot of people do is only read the anthologies like the Best American Short Stories or the Pushcart Prize, which is great, by the way. I mean, that stuff has been properly filtered usually, so you are going to get the best. But when I'm reading these little journals, man, I discover so much interesting stuff. There's really a lot of stuff that the big publishers don't want to be publishing. So I think it's a great exercise. I think it's a really fun part of my job. I understand that clients come to me because they don't want to read 400 literary journals and figure out which ones match their work. I mean, that's what I do. That's the value added more than anything. But I do often say, you know, at least read the anthologies, especially the smaller ones. There's a great one called The Best Small Fictions, I think it's what it's called. So it's flash fiction. It tends to publish small journals. The Pushcart Prize will sometimes publish things from interesting journals. The Best American Short Stories tends to just be The New Yorker, The New Yorker, The New Yorker, and The Paris Review, and then The New Yorker a few more times. But there's lots of interesting stuff out there. So I think it's great to read this stuff.
One of the books that we covered for our podcast was Ray Bradbury's Zen and the Art of Writing. And he recounts in that how he was writing short stories, and this was enough to support his wife. And until eventually the short stories added up and he got an agent and he got a publisher and he got a book deal. So it was kind of a very romantic way of looking at this whole system. Does it still work that way?
I don't think so. Well, at least not in the money part. I mean, I wrote a blog post a couple of years ago called something like How I Made 2 cents per hour as a writer last year and how you can too. And I've been published a lot. Obviously, I spend hours and hours and hours writing like we all do. And, you know, maybe I make $250 or $300 on a published story every couple of years. So you do the math and nobody's making money, and, you know, unless your name's George Saunders or something, selling short stories. And every now and then I get a client who will say something like, I only want to submit to journals that pay. And I kind of want to say, you realize most journals that pay kind of pay like $5 or, you know, $10 Canadian or something, which is like $5 American. And it just doesn't make any sense. You're spending a few hundred dollars for my service. The likelihood of finding a journal that's going to pay that way is small anyway. So maybe you break even if you're lucky and get published in a really great journal. So no, I don't think anyone's really doing this to make money now, but the Bradbury story is perfect in the sense that getting published in literary journals, I do think, is a great way to become a professional writer down the road in many ways, not just that you're working on your craft in small bites rather than, you know, writing your first 700-page novel and being a different writer by the end than you were at the beginning, because you're still developing as a writer. So, I mean, I think there's reasons to explore the short form from the nature of developing your voice and style and craft and so on. But, you know, when the time comes and you do have a larger project to sell, to be able to approach agents and say, hey, I've been published here, 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 and here. All of a sudden, agents like, okay, this is something I want to take a look at, rather than I've never been published anywhere. Please look at my 700-page novel. And, you know, and people might notice you as well. It hasn't happened for me, but I have heard of, you know, you get something published somewhere and somebody sees it and says, hey, I really love it. What are you working on? What's your big project? And maybe it's a publisher and maybe it's an agent.
Any other reasons?
You know, writing is a real solitary activity. And we're all sort of sitting here in front of our laptops. I work from home with no music on. So it's like I'm alone doing this for hours every day. And I feel like to get an occasional work published is the kind of thing that just keeps you going. Mm-hmm. There's just something in your heart about getting published that feels good. And I think that's important too. all of those, I think, are good reasons to develop a resume. Here's who I am. I've been published here, here, and here for when you do start looking for agents or go directly to publishers. But also just those little victories, I think, are important.
Also, when your parents ask you what you've been up to, you can actually say something, even if they never read the journal.
Yeah. And that's the other thing. It's like most people I know haven't read my work, but at least I can say, hey, if you're interested, you know, I have a website now with links to here's some of the works. When I was a musician, you go play a show and you tell all your friends, I'm playing a show, and people come out and actually see what you're doing. But when you're writing, so much of it is never seen. I think that's important for you as a writer. I don't think everyone needs that. I think there's some writers who are content to, you know, sit at home for 15 years working on their craft, and then finally they're ready and say, here it is. And an agent finds them and great, you know, everyone's happy. But I think for a lot of people, you do want those little milestones along the way.
So submitting to magazines is just kind of now part of the writing process in a way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if everyone does it. It's certainly my approach. And I think it's a lot of people's approach. You know, when you get a novel, especially a first novel, and you go to the copyright page and it says something like portions of this novel have been published here, and thank you to the New Yorker, and thank you to, you know, whatever, especially story collections. And I know a lot of writers start out with a story collection because that's what they've been working on for, you know, the first 10 years of their life as writers. So I know that a lot of writers do get started with literary journals. I think it's a logical way to go. You know, going back to something I said a few minutes ago, it's a way to develop as a writer. So I kind of feel like you should be doing it anyway. So if you're writing short stories anyway, it seems like why not be throwing them out to literary journals? You know, one other reason, if you're sending your short stories out and never getting published and getting nothing but form replies, that's feedback. You know, that's like the musician who can't get into a band or audition. You know, if you're classical, you're auditioning and no one's hiring you. I mean, you're learning something there. And, you know, maybe you're like the next James Joyce and people just don't understand what you're doing yet, you know, or fill in the blank. But I think there's a pretty good chance that you just need to maybe hire an editor to give you some feedback or keep working or keep reading or, you know, so I think that that's a really important part of this whole process. Instead of looking at failure as failure, look at it as an opportunity to keep working on your craft. But that said, you know, if you're only submitting to the New Yorker and the Paris Review and getting rejected, that doesn't mean anything at all.
Also, the act of submitting and getting rejected and then submitting somewhere else is a good way to build up some tough skin.
Yes, you better have tough skin if you're going to be a writer, as we all know. And if a few years of submitting to literary journals without success is enough to, you know, have you go into law or become a doctor, please go into law or become a doctor. I promise you, you're going to make more money there and it's probably easier.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when I was publishing in small presses, when I was graduated from my MFA program in poetry and I was doing the game, you know, it was actually motivating. Because they publish on a schedule. And so because I didn't no longer had a imposed schedule from teachers and, you know, getting my thesis done and all this other stuff, having deadlines to get stuff into magazines actually became the deadlines for me to get work in and actually write more. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of nice.
Yeah, for sure.
Here's a question. What, in your opinion, is the main reason that fiction gets rejected?
Or creative nonfiction?
Okay. Yeah. So I don't know if you were purposely leading into part of how Submitit works, but I will tell you the big thing with Submitit, my company, is I have this algorithm that I use to score. I don't love using the word score, but for lack of a better word, score or analyze, let's say, a writer's work. Mm-hmm. And I use the same criteria when I read stories and essays in literary journals. And so that the algorithm, essentially, its job is to marry stories to journals. And one of the things I decided when I started this company and started working on the algorithm and started reading these stories, because I had to decide, well, what exactly am I going to be looking at? And I sort of figured this out as I was reading journals. I feel like the qualities of the prose the language itself, the sound of the prose, is the one through line in a journal. So you might have a story about politics that's very topical with real people in it. And then the next story, you know, might be sort of kind of like literary science fiction or something. I mean, completely different subject matter. But I noticed that there was a familiarity or a similarity in the quality of the prose itself. So when I wrote The Algorithm, my primary focus, it's about, I think, 45% of how I score stories has to do with the prose. I do consider other things, topicality and tone and underrepresented voices, international themes, and so on. But it's really about the quality of the prose. So I think when a journal gets a story that's spectacularly well-written, it has musicality to it, that is the best chance of getting published. The problem with my answer, though, is every journal is different. And there are journals that seem less concerned about the quality of the writing and much more concerned about topicality and subject matter and things like that. And again, my algorithm, if it's doing its job right, is going to marry a story that I don't think is written in a lyrical manner or isn't concerned with craft and so on, with those journals that also seem to publish that way. So maybe the better question is, why do the best journals reject fiction or creative nonfiction? And I think the answer is the best journals do so usually because the quality of the writing isn't there. I mean, yes, character and plot and structure and all of these big picture things need to work. But I kind of think that the password to get past that first line, you know, of defenses to do we like the plot and the characters, et cetera, is the writing strong enough? So I'm really focused when I edit, my focus is largely on the quality of the writing. And sometimes I'll get to the end and say, I don't know, I love the plot, I love the characters, all that stuff works great. We need to work on, you know, the flow of your sentences or whatever. Sometimes I do read something and I say the plot's not working for me. There's something wrong with the structure. I had a story last week. If you heard the rule, like start as close to the end of a story as you can and then flash back and tell the rest of the story. Mm-hmm. And by now everybody knows that. So it's really kind of boring. and this story I told the writer, I said, you know, it just sounds to me like somebody told you to start at the end of the story and then didn't feel natural at all. And so there's an example where it's not at all about the quality of the writing. It was the structure bothered me. And the writer ended up rewriting it. And I read the second draft. It was just much better and much more natural. So we do focus on those other things. Talk about a long answer.
No, it's fine. No, it's something that we all really, really wonder about. So it's really cool to get an opinion, even, you know, from your experience with that. I know that for my program, we learned how to look at a magazine and kind of get a feel for what their styles were and pick that out. After you get past the musicality of the words, do you think certain journals gravitate towards certain genres of musicality? Like, you know, some people like, you know, more Hemingway-esque, some people would like more lyrical.
A great question and not an easy question to answer, but I think journals are less specific about that, about the kind of musicality or lyricism than whether it's there or not. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I'm reading a journal that I know publishes very craft-heavy lyrical writing, I don't feel like I'm reading the same story again and again, quite the opposite. But I do know that each story is going to be full of those sort of stylistic elements. And conversely, a journal that doesn't seem particularly interested in a concern for craft and sound and lyricism and all of the whatever words we want to use tends to not over and over again be concerned with it. So it's not so much, is the writing like Hemingway or is it, you know, I mean, there are exceptions. You know, if we want to talk about experimental form, that's a little different. So there are journals that the stories tend to be experimental, and we can be experimental and lyrical and experimental and not lyrical and lyrical and not experimental and, you know, and so on. So there are some things that I can look at. You know, a journal like Conjunctions is going to be experimental and probably lyrical. There are many small journals out there that publish experimental fiction, like one sentence stories and things like that, but that aren't necessarily crafty or lyrical you know, so I might give it a lower score in craft, like the writer's not really doing anything interesting at the word and sentence level, but at the formal level, the paragraph level, there are interesting things. I wish there were easy answers to these things. This is why I think I've read 2,000 stories in the last couple of years, so that I can kind of, you know, figure this stuff out, because each journal can be a little different. And I'll say one other thing. There are some journals that sort of publish a little bit of everything. So I might see a story that's, you know, full of craft and lyricism, and then the next one is very basic writing. It's much more about the story and the characters. And then the next story is, you know, I don't know, written in reverse language. So it's completely experimental, and that's fine. And it just becomes a very vanilla score in my algorithm, which actually makes sense because they sort of publish a little bit of everything. So you're never going to, a client story is never going to match perfectly with that journal, but no client story is ever going to match terribly with it also.
And just to keep going on what Submitit does, you looked at one of my stories and I found it to be quite extensive edits that you gave back on it, which very helpful edits. How much of the success of your clients you think is due to like picking the right journals to submit to, and how much is working with a professional editor that's going to give some very like stylistic feedback as well on a piece?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it depends on the writer, you know, and it depends on the level of editing. So I know with your piece, I think I mentioned at the end, I ended up focusing more on copy editing. I know we talked about it, and we can talk about it more at some point, but I focused a lot on just punctuation. And, you know, so I do think that from a strictly grammar and usage perspective, a lot of journals are not going to spend a lot of time on a story if, you know, on the first page, there's 20 grammar usage errors. Not that you had 20 grammar usage errors on your first page, but I get work a lot that just dramatically needs a lot of work just in terms of grammar and usage, which I have a background in. I mean, I love grammar and I have a bunch of grammar guides right in front of me. They're like my little Bibles. That story is just not going to get accepted, especially to smaller journals that don't have time to do a ton of editing on their own. But I don't think the bigger journals want to also. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I do like to focus on things like style. And I get a lot of work from clients who haven't really thought about that. They're just, I have a great story to tell, and I want to just tell the story in as simple a way as possible. So part of, I think, my job when I'm hired to do a developmental or a line edit is to say, you know, I'd love more variation in your sentences. Or I noticed that this 8,000 word story has not one metaphor, you know? And that's okay. But, you know, literary fiction, especially for shooting for top journals, tends to be metaphorical. So, Kim, I'm sure I did this from time to time in my edit of your work, but I use a couple of anthologies and I'll say, here's a great story to check out so you can kind of understand what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. When I edit, I do try to teach as well as, you know, improve the work. So yeah, I think it can make a difference. When I do edit, I score a client's story with the assumption that they're going to listen to some of the things I have to say. So I'm optimistic in that sense. And that will raise the scores, which will better match to journals in theory. And again, I'd say probably half of my clients don't do any editing at all. They're experienced writers. They know what they're doing. Not always, but you know, sometimes they think they know what they're doing and sometimes they really do know what they're doing. And that's a pleasure too. And then all I'm doing is reading the story to be able to score it for the algorithm.
Are there any additional things someone can include when they're submitting their pieces that might increase chances of acceptance? Specifically, I'm talking about the query letter and the bio, which you asked me to write.
I think it matters not at all. maybe we should say 1% chance that it makes a difference. I was more into it when I started the company a few years ago. It's like, let's get the bio right. Kim, I don't know if you had a chance. I have a whole blog post on how to write a bio and how to write.
Yeah, I read all your blog posts.
Okay. Yeah. Over the years, I've heard from editors in interviews, and they just all kind of say, it doesn't matter. If the story is great, we're going to publish you, even if your bio says, my name's Bob. And if the story is not good, they're not going to publish you, you know, unless your bio says, I'm George Saunders, and then absolutely they're going to publish you. Unless you're a superstar writer already, I don't think the bio really makes a difference. It's really there more for if you get published, they want something to put at the bottom of the story to say who you are. even more so, I don't think the blurb really matters. It's just, I've always written a blurb, you know, and a lot of journals read blind. So I guarantee you it doesn't matter for those journals. And it's not a small percentage of journals that don't even want to see your name before they read the piece. I feel like I'm constantly telling clients who are sort of stressing out about the bio and the blurb, and it's like, it just doesn't matter. You want to get it to sound nice in case you get published. But even then, it's like, you could probably change it if you get published and say, oh, I don't, can I change my bio? Like, what are they going to say? No, your bio is set in stone. So no, I don't think the bio, the cover letter, the blurb, whatever you want to call it, I actually don't think that matters at all. Focus on the story.
One of the things that we learned or whatever, and when I was going through school, you submit and you try to get the first few publications. So at least you have a list, you know, in your cover letter, like, I've published in this place, this place, this place.
Yeah.
And we were told that it can't hurt.
For sure it can't hurt.
It can help, maybe. Do you want to speak to that? Like, do you think that it, you know, the more you publish in, the more you're going to get published? Or do you think that that just...
Again, I don't think it really matters. It's funny, your words are the same as my words at the end of my blog post, which say, I don't think this matters all that much, but it can't hurt. And I think it's great to be able to say, so-and-so has been published in a variety of journals, including, and then three or four, and the better they are, the better. You know, I don't know. I have a pretty good resume, and I don't think I'm getting published more than I would if my bio was, my name's Bob. I just really don't feel like I am. I just don't think the bio matters as much as people think. And I guess I've sort of come around to think that because that's what editors are saying. I don't know if you guys have heard of the Substack page, Lit Mag News. Becky Tuck is kind of a friend of mine, and she interviews editors from journals a lot. It's a really interesting place to go just to kind of get that perspective. I don't think I've ever seen an editor say that they care about the bio. I think 100%. I haven't seen everyone, but everyone that I've heard, the editors just say, yeah, no, the bio doesn't really matter. I have heard editors say, we'd love to know how you heard about the journal or why you're sending your work to me. And that might help more than anything. Again, unless your name is George Saunders. So assuming you're not a superstar writer, to be able to say, I've been reading your journal for years. I read this particular story by this particular writer, which really reminded me of my own work. I love what you're doing. I hope you'll consider my story. Like, that would be great. I can't do that with Submit It because it would just take us forever, you know, but if you really do love a particular journal, I don't know, maybe that would help. I don't do that personally with my own work. Again, it just feels like too much work. And it also would mean that you're sort of picking one or two or at most maybe five journals to read in depth and really get to know and maybe subscribe to. Can you imagine subscribing to a literary journal? You know, so there's a commitment there, and now you're really limiting the number of journals that you're submitting to. I mean, if you're only submitting to five journals, even if you're saying, I love your journal and I've read that, you know, I don't know if that's necessarily the way to go. I would rather somebody read 20, 30 or 40 journals and get to know all those journals and sort of decide which ones you really like. Yeah. It's again, another long-winded answer. If you're going to do anything, embrace a journal and say a few words, address the editor directly. Maybe that will give you a small chance. But look, if the story's not good or the essay is not good, I don't think it's going to matter. And I think if the story's great and the essay is great, the bio and cover letter aren't going to keep you out of the journal.
One other thing I was thinking about is that there's the literary journals, but there's also some genre publications, yeah, like the science fiction or the mystery or the horror. Do you work with any of those or is that separate?
It's separate. I would like to someday. The other big one is poetry. I without exaggerating, I'd say two or three times a month, I get somebody, do you do poetry? Please tell me you do poetry. You know, we're starting to get a nice reputation. So it's inevitable that people, that poets are going to want us to do the same thing. At this point, it's just too much work for me personally. I'm also not, I don't consider myself an expert of genre fiction. Mm-hmm. And I am certainly not an expert of poetry. So it would involve me hiring somebody who really knows these forms and telling that person, okay, let's maybe start with 200 or so journals, which is enough, I think, to get a good variety of journals and read two or three or four poems or more. If you're having trouble getting a feel for the journal, let's create an algorithm. And so, you know, it took me well over a year just to get submitted off the ground because I had to read all these journals and I had to read all these stories. So
did you just say that 200 journals?
Well, I have about 500 journals right now in my database. Yeah. So it's, you know, every week I add one or two journals. There's all these new journals coming in. And then, like I said before, journals go away. When somebody sends me their work, I want to feel pretty confident that I'm going to be able to find a journal or, you know, frankly, 10 journals or 20 journals to send that client's work to. There's actually well over 1,000 literary. Like if you go to Duotrope, it's crazy how many journals there are. So yeah, I think you need to have a pretty good database in place before clients start sending you their work so that you can find strong matches.
Now, also sometimes journals open for periods and then close for periods. So when you're doing stuff, are you actually in your database also keeping track of when you can submit to these various places?
For sure. Yeah, I use Duotrope for that. It's not an exact science. I think Duotrope misses some openings and some closings, but it's pretty good. And Kim, as we continue to go through the process with your work, you'll see all this. When I produce a list of journals before we submit, we send the list to the client. I think for you, we're doing two rounds of 10 journals. So our full 20 journal package. In the first round, we want to submit to 10 journals, but we'll send you maybe 15 journals. Mm-hmm. That's really for two reasons. One, you might look at the list and say, oh, I really hate this particular journal. Please take that one off the list. So we have a little bit of cushion there for a client to give us some input. But the other reason is when my associate, Christine, who does the submissions, when she gets to a journal, maybe the journal closed in the last couple of days. You know, maybe it's one of those journals that has rolling deadlines or something mm-hmm. where once they hit a limit, then they close. So we want to make sure we have enough journals there so that we can make it to 10. Mm-hmm. But, you know, back to your question, I use Duotrope, which once a week they send out a newsletter. All of these journals are now open. All of these journals have now closed. And I go through, it doesn't take that long, but I go through my database and just click open, open, closed, closed, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Part of our job.
Does your algorithm take into account contests? I know that's very important, especially for poets. Contests or anthologies?
No. And again, that's just like poetry and like genre fiction. I would love to expand to contests someday. It's absolutely something we could do. You know, in a sense, maybe it's a little harder because I think contests have more variation because it's so dependent on the judge.
Right. The editors.
Or judges, or, you know, which change. So, and by the way, editors change at journals too. So I do mm-hmm. have to stay on top of that. But starting submitted, I wanted to focus on my strengths as a writer and as a submitter and my own experiences. And I tried contests real early in my writing career, like twice, and thought, oh, I'm going to win for sure both times. And,
of course.
Yeah, you better be confident, right? As a writer, I mean, absurdly confident. And I didn't obviously win either contest. And I was like, ah, this kind of sucks. I'm not going to spend $25 or $35 and when I could submit for $3 or whatever. So I don't do contests, but I don't discommend them. I mean, there are people who love doing contests and occasionally think it's worth it. So to answer your question, we don't do contests. I'd love to do contests someday. First, for me, is probably poetry because I get asked so often. I also want to learn more about poetry, so it would be a good excuse to, you know, buy some poetry books and call it a write-off or whatever.
It is quite the different beast.
They're also shorter.
Not always.
Yeah. And if they're not short, that's probably one of the categories in my, but I would have to hire a poet. So I wouldn't trust myself. I'm not going to become a poet in 6 months. So,
right.
But it would be fun to kind of get my hands in there a little bit.
Probably a lot of out of work poets.
There are a lot of out of work poets.
I would have no problem finding a poet. Well, I'm sure. Yeah.
The problem is there are so many different genres of poetry and, you know, what are the ones that are experts in the ones, you know, how many do you need to hire, I guess, is what you're trying to say.
Yeah. I mean, I'd have to find somebody who just really knows poetry in a very broad sense, which I hope for me as a fiction reader and writer and editor, particularly as an editor, I have to be pretty broad-minded in what I know. I actually do a fair amount of genre editing. I don't submit through Submitit, but I'm also an editor on this editing site called Readsy that you may have heard of.
Yep.
And from Readsy, I get all kinds of stuff. Science stuff and academic stuff and lots of genre stuff and not a ton of literary fiction. So it keeps me sort of active in that regard. And I have to read some Stephen King on occasion. And I love science fiction. It's like my guilty pleasure. And you mentioned Ray Bradbury, and I didn't even say anything, but I love Ray Bradbury. My local library is the Ray Bradbury branch of the Los Angeles Public Library. And
was that where he used to write?
I think so. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cause we covered that about like the typewriters that you
the
had.
Remington.
I wrote an essay a few years ago that was published in the Somerset Review, and I sent it to the director of the library, and they ended up framing it. And I'm not quite a celebrity when I go in there, but there was a little while where, you know, I wanted to go see the room, the Ray Bradbury room, and like, oh, you're the guy who wrote the essay. So yeah.
That's cool. I think that, I mean, I you're kind of a celebrity to me now. That's awesome.
One of my favorite bookmarks, I wish you were right in front of me because I'm probably going to mess it up, but it's a Ray Bradbury quote. And I think it says, you don't need to burn books to suppress society. You just need to get people to stop reading them or something like that. So yeah, so I'm a Bradbury fan and a science fiction fan.
Is there anything else you want to say about Submit It before we, or you have this classic question I really love, which is, what was that question you have in other interviews? Oh, well, there's always the, is there anything that you thought I would ask you about your company that I did not ask?
That's a good question. Nothing that I can think of. Yeah, you've covered it. I mean, you know, we could get as crazy as you want in terms of how the algorithm works, but I think it's, I think you get the point.
That's okay. I think you've actually done a really good job of explaining what went into the algorithm. You can trust that you know what you're talking about, but also appreciate the amount of work you put into it that mm-hmm. I myself would not want to do.
Yeah. And I think that that's the ultimate service that we provide. I mean, anybody could submit their work. It's a pain, but anybody could really do it. But what's hard to do is read tons and tons of literary journals to figure out where to send your work. And I think that that's our greatest value, is that we've done the work. We've read the journals, and we've gone underneath those top 50 that everybody's heard of that reject everyone. So we're greatly increasing the chances of writers getting published because we're looking at those smaller journals and newer journals and so on. And we do get people published. I mean, that's the crazy thing. When I started the company, I knew how hard it was to get published. And I thought, ugh, what if the algorithm doesn't work? You know, there was a leap of faith that you can actually figure out a way to marry stories to journals. And it's working. I mean, we're getting around 2/3 of our stories published, which is an insane percentage.
Wow.
Yeah. The last time I checked, it was 66.8% or something like that. And I am almost 100% sure that we're stronger now. I just haven't had a chance to run the data for 2023 yet. So I got to do that soon. But we're somewhere in the neighborhood of probably between 60 and 80%. I have these notes. I'm obviously not going to use any clients' names right now, but I have these notes to my associate, Christine. I'm like, if we get this one published, we are gods. And then we'll get them published. And then sometimes the writers will say, well, I don't know, what do you think of this journal? I'm like, oh my God, say yes. You have no idea how lucky you are to be getting this thing published. So yeah, it seems to work.
I think it's a great service, not just for the writer, but for the magazine as well. Because when a magazine is starting out, right, you're really trying to get people to submit, and it's really hard. And if you've got that fledgling flag, yeah, on the Duotrope website for your magazine, you know, how are you getting people to submit and quality stuff? Your service is also beneficial, not just for writers, but for magazines.
I think so. Yeah. And we're also sending magazines work that apparently they like to read. Journals actually don't know we are the middleman. So we create a shared email for our clients and submit on their behalf using the shared email. I did that on purpose. I had to decide, do I think that journals want to know that they're getting their work from a submission company or not? And for some reason, I just felt like that was something that a journal editor, without thinking about it, would say, oh, I don't want a service sending me I don't know why exactly. And I could be wrong about that. But I've asked a few other people and they all said, yeah, it doesn't make sense why a journal wouldn't want submit it to be sending clients work, because we're using the algorithm to make sure the work is appropriate. But in any case, we don't do it. There are some journals that tend to jump high on my algorithm frequently, and we send a lot of work their way, and they have no idea that we're doing it. I mean, I purposely do things to make sure that it doesn't seem like everything's coming. You know, I'll change the cover letters a little bit, and I change the formatting a little bit. Do I have to be doing that? I'm not sure. It's just a hunch that I have that.
It doesn't hurt. Yeah, it doesn't hurt.
Yeah, I don't think it hurts. Yeah.
The submission process for me, at least this was right after I graduated, which was 2009 or whatever. So for like a year, I was playing the game after graduation. And man, it takes a long time. And to me, I felt like a machine, you know?
Yeah.
Like I had my own internal kind of algorithm and I had no money because I'm, you know, an adjunct instructor and I've just started. Yeah. I've got all these student loans, so I couldn't afford to buy these magazines. So I would go online and I would find, you know, sometimes they would publish the poems. Some poems would get published. It's like, okay, well, I can get an idea of what their style's like. Is this something that I could submit to? And then I was using Duotrope and all these other things. And, you know, and I would send out tons of these emails and I was like, well, how am I keeping track of all these emails that I'm sending? I hope I don't send them the same one already, or did I already send them something? It was just, you become your own secretary.
For sure. It's a lot of work. You know, I still publish my own work and I'm still keeping track of it. My background before music is actually in engineering. And when I was getting my master's as an engineer, we were allowed to take a class in the business school. It was some sort of like
correlative course.
Yeah, like one business class you're allowed to take. I don't think it went the other way, by the way. I don't think there were a lot of business students walking over and taking, you know, calculus 5000 or whatever. So I took this business course. It was like an entrepreneurial course. And the professor said, you know, find something that you hate to do and figure out a way to do it better. And there's your business. And that's sort of what made me think to do submit it. I hated submitting. I hated finding journals. I didn't want to read tons of literary journals. So of course I created a company that requires me to read tons of literary journals. But, you know, that was the idea. And every element of it, from finding the journals, reading the journals, actually doing the submissions. As you know, different journals have different guidelines. So you got to go in and change the font from Times New Roman to Arial for some ungodly reason, or take the page numbers away for some journals, add the page numbers for other journals, whatever. Like all of those things are just such a pain. And I thought, well, there's obviously the company I need to run or start. That's why I did it, for better or for worse.
Okay, so we'll finish up with just a little bit of talking about the story that I submitted to you. Well, first of all, I actually did appreciate the editing that you did. It was kind of a nice way of seeing what an editor would see when they look through my work.
Sure.
And picking up on that stuff and the punctuation. I think I'm a little bit dyslexic and I have a hard time. I have a horrible time spelling, but like remembering where periods and commas go. I don't approach my writing from a grammar sort of way as much as, well, it sounds like you should have a pause here, so I'll put a comma.
Yeah, yeah. You know, as I said before, I ended up really doing more of a copy edit, which is really focused on those things, the grammar and the usage and the punctuation, especially. I think I wrote at some point, you know, we have all these different punctuation marks, all of these different options. I will look at that stuff, even if I'm not editing. Like if I see a bunch of missing commas. I mean, I've read a million things, of course, since I read your story, so I can't remember everything, but there were a lot of comma splices. Mm-hmm. And I remember there being missing commas before coordinating conjunctions in compound sentences. And I see both of those things all the time. And then we have colons, and we have semicolons, and we have M dashes. And then also being consistent. So, you know, if we're going to put a comma after yesterday, comma, I went to the park, but then two sentences later, tomorrow I will stay home with no comma. It's like, those are the things that I'm sort of looking for when I'm doing my copy editing, is making sure things are consistent, making sure that the marks are used correctly. We're going to use an M dash for an interruption. We're going to use an ellipsis for hesitation or a pause. I mean, these are different uses. I think these things are important to get right, because many, if not all, or at least most editors, we would hope, are also kind of like nerdy grammarians like me, and will be turned off if they're reading a work that has a number of, you know, solecisms in terms of grammar and so on.
Kim, did you come away with any like insights about your story?
You pointed out a couple of places where I really didn't set the scene for location.
That's right.
And some of the descriptive elements that were missing. And there was one section where it kind of went on a little ways and I cut that out.
Good.
Just some overall big picture stuff that maybe the people that know me that read the thing wouldn't pick up on that you picked up on.
Yeah. And I mean, structurally, I loved what you did. I mean, I love the I don't want to give anything away. Well, I guess I will give things away. But the POV shift, the point of view shift at the end, I thought was wonderful. I did not see that coming. I love swerves like that. And you handled it well. It didn't feel amateurish at all. It felt like this is where I'm heading this whole time. I love complex, interesting, flawed characters. And I thought you nailed it with our main character. I mean, we're little by little, we're kind of like, we want to shake the mom's shoulders and say, stop it. And that's the feeling I want to have when I read.
The recurring comment I get from everybody, that female that reads it, is, oh my God, that's my mother.
Yeah. So that's important though. It's like, you've created a realistic character. You know, I reread Lolita last year, and I just think it's the greatest novel ever written. And here we are in the mind of this pedophile, but we, to our horror, don't want to leave it. You know, it's so he's created this terrible, unlikable character, but it's so well-rounded and so on. So I'm not comparing the mom with Humbert, but yeah, it's like that. That's important stuff. And I would have mentioned that if I had issues. So yeah, it just depends on the story, and it depends on the level of editing that the client wants me to do. For you, I was much less concerned about character development and structure, and more concerned about punctuation and so on. Regarding scene development and details, I mean, this is another thing. I happen to love details. I'm a detailist. I mean, when I write, I have sort of absurd amounts of details. My favorite writers are sort of the postmodern detailists, the French writers like Robespierre and Georges Perec and those guys who just, you know, they don't even need a plot. I think Georges Perec, I haven't read this one yet, but he wrote either a short story or a whole novel that's just like 5 minutes on a street corner. He wanted to see if he could actually capture literally everything from the tiniest speck of dust to the sound of every bird and so on. I have to be careful, obviously. I don't want to tell all my writers to write like that, but I need to know where things are sort of happening most of the time. Mm-hmm. Unless the writer is writing experimentally in a way that it's perfectly fine. In other words, it's clearly intended that we shouldn't know where things are happening, or things should be blurry in sort of a, you know, literally a Kafka-esque sense. When you read Kafka, oftentimes you're not really sure where things are taking place, which is his point, I think. One thing that I find writers do, and maybe you did this, maybe you didn't, I can't remember, but they'll be very careful about scene development and details for one scene, and then we'll get to another scene and there's nothing, mm-hmm. or very, very little. That, to me, a good reader will read that as a mistake. Because why are you describing this important scene in great detail, the sunlight and the shadows and the people and so on, and then we get to this other scene and I have nothing to see, nothing to experience? I think it happens when the writer actually knows exactly what they're trying to write in terms of content and subject. Like, oh, this is really important. I'm really going to get into this character's psyche here or something. And so then they focus less on the room that it's happening in. The writing needs to be spectacularly good for a writer to not develop scenes. Otherwise, it feels like the writer just didn't know to do so. Mm-hmm. At one of my notes, I don't think I had this note on your piece. Maybe I did, but I do have a note that says, you know, think like a film director. Are you able to see and experience, and not just, and I shouldn't say just see, I think all five senses should be considered. Are you able to experience what's happening on the page? Because if you're not able to experience what's happening, a huge part of storytelling is being neglected. most of the time. Again, I mean, again, if it's an experimental piece and you're clearly not trying to develop scenes, that's fine. But 99% of writers really should be developing their scenes and creating details. And that's like the first step. I mean, we could talk about this all day, but then once there's an awareness of, oh yeah, I need to explain that this is taking place at a school and give me something about it, then the next step is how to make that interesting and beautiful. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times with writers, I'll say, you know, you're not developing your scenes, you're not using details, blah, blah, blah. Basically, that could be anything. You're not using metaphors, you're not varying your sentences, etc. So then they'll sort of, oh, that's a new box I need to check. And they start checking those boxes. So it's making things interesting, finding interesting details, and having it all sound good and reading it aloud. Word repetition comes up a lot. Did I write that on your piece?
There were a couple of places that I did it, but overall, I'm pretty keyed into that. So
that's pretty common. I just edited a piece last week that was over and over again, word repetition. And then the other side of the word repetition coin is what I call thesaurusization. It's my made up word. I probably never even said it out loud. Thesaurusization, using a thesaurus, you know?
Yes.
So this person was talking about acne. So it was acne. And then the next sentence, it was pimples. And then the next sentence, it was zits. And it just sounds like, oh, I can't repeat acne. So let's use a thesaurus to see what comes up. Oh, okay, we'll do zits. And, you know, unfortunately, that's what it was. But the beauty of being an editor, beauty or whore, either both, I guess, is that I get to see all of these things and I expect them. I have a lot of my comments, to be honest, are pre-written.
I noticed they were very slick. I felt a little bit guilty that you'd put so much into the comments, but I think, like, you know, you reference certain writings or certain things again and again.
So I use Chicago Manual of Style primarily for grammar and usage. It's a wonderful guide and it's sort of the go-to for literary writing. If I have a question, I'd say at least 90% of the time I can find the answer in Chicago Manual of Style. And I also like to refer to it so that if a writer kind of looks at something, like I might say, you know, you should really put a comma here. And here's why Chicago Manual of Style 6, chapter 6, 1, you know, section 12. I feel like the writer is less likely to say, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, when I can say, no, the Chicago Manual of Style is telling you to do it. And here's what they're saying. And then you can decide whether you want the comma or not.
So I'm going to shift now from the grammar stuff to, in general, what I notice about my own writing is I'm pretty good on plot. I'm pretty good on characters and dialogue. I am not good at descriptive language nearly as much. I was a science journalist. I'm really good at explaining stuff. I'm really good at, like, writing a scene, like when I'm in a place. But, like, the metaphor and some of the more elegant language and all that kind of evades me. I mean, obviously, we should all improve what we're not good at. And so it will be something I continue to work at. But as a short story writer that I'm right now, how successful can I be if I'm not as stylized as other writers?
You know, I think, first of all, finding the stylists and reading them is number one. I mean, it's when I have a note that says, I think you should write more details. And here are some standout short stories in various anthologies that I recommend you look at. Like, that to me is the way to start, just to kind of hear it. Going back to music, I was a drummer, and a jazz drummer, and the way to develop as a jazz drummer. Yeah, I had to spend 10 hours a day in the practice room, of course, but I really needed to listen to the right people. And I think listen is the key word, because you are listening with your inner ear when you're reading, you know, so reading the stylist, reading to Buckoff and Rick Bass and all of those writers, I think is a great place to start. And the anthologies are great because you'll learn about people that maybe you haven't read before. I think Rick Bass is sort of the master of the stylists and the detailists. And if you read him and you say, wow, that really was just a phenomenal piece. And then you go out and buy a collection of his short stories and you go from there. So I think that's number one. And no, that doesn't happen tomorrow. So I think maybe number two is awareness. So, oh, I'm not writing details very much. I'm not thinking to. So I hope as an editor that I'm alerting writers to this lack. And then one of the things, I don't think I mentioned this on your piece, but one of the things I do frequently recommend is, like, going through a story after you've written the plot, the part that, Kim, you've admitted is your strength, and saying, okay, I want to go through the story now, and I call it a details edit. And I'm going to do nothing but look for opportunities to describe things. Mm-hmm. And take a few weeks and go through it, and you get to hit a paragraph and like, God, I feel like maybe there should be some beautiful lighting here, and let's figure out how to write that. And so you're really turning off the part of your thinking that is focused on character and plot and structure and focusing just on the little stuff. You have no choice but to focus on that in a details edit. And you can do an edit like that with all kinds of things. I mean, I sometimes say go through and do a figurative language edit where you're only going through looking for opportunities to write metaphors. So that's sort of number two, just this awareness and this focus on this part of your writing. And I guess the third thing I'll say is you can't rush this stuff. So I think it's about practicing. So it's the reading and the awareness, but then it's also doing it. And maybe even challenging yourself to write a story like Perec did with The Street Corner. Have you guys read Gariel Lutz? Now Gariel, and she's just a total friggin' rock star and writes in a completely different language. It's still English, but it doesn't feel like it. And the way that she writes details, it's never just, there's a pencil on my desk. There's a whole other level of writing details. And that's sort of where I'm pushing writers. So yeah, it takes a lot of time, but I think it's reading people that maybe aren't like the people that you're normally reading. If you're not focusing on details, Kim, it tells me that you're probably not reading those writers that I call the detailists. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that I want my writers to become detailists or metaphor experts or, you know, sentence variation gurus, or, you know, I'm not trying to turn writers into other writers, but I am trying to say, open yourself to these other styles of writing, because all of it sort of flows into your own style over time. It's an awareness.
Yeah. Right. And actually, one of the advantages of writing short stories is it gives you a chance to keep trying that again and again. Because like for my novel, everything's sort of set. You know, yeah, there's only so much variation I can do when I'm writing it. But if you're doing a short story, you can pick a nice short story and say, this is what I'm going to focus on for this piece.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the reasons to work on the short form, is because you're developing your voice over time. I wrote a very long novel that I finished a few months ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was like a 9-year endeavor. And I'm just starting the agent search and all that fun stuff. I definitely noticed that by the end of the novel, I was a totally different writer, because I'm still a relatively young writer. I mean, I've been writing for a little over, I don't know, somewhere between 10 and 15 years. So of course you would expect to grow considerably from 9 years ago to today. So I had to go back and kind of rewrite a lot of the earlier chapters. And in a way, I wish I had just written short stories for those 9 years so that I wouldn't have to do, you know, do so much reworking of past stuff. But yeah, I think writing short stories and it's your chance to experiment and find your voice. And I think we're all always finding our voice. I don't think we're like really done. It's the way to do it for sure. And that's also real easy to write something and say, God, that sucks, and throw it away. You don't want to write a 9-year novel and say, well, that sucks, and what's next, you know?
I have one last question, which is, since you started Submit It and went through all those journals, has your own short story acceptance rate gone up?
Yeah, I think it probably has, for sure. I mean, yeah, I guess I have one interesting story to tell. So I've been working on to finish my novel. Most of last year was really intensive novel writing. The novel is 20 chapters, and I've had about 10 of the chapters published in literary journals, which to me felt like enough. So when I'm starting the agent search, to be able to list, you know, 10 journals that chapters have been published in, I felt like that's great. Any more than that, it's just needless. So I hadn't been publishing very much, but I also felt like, you know, I'm running this submission company. So I want to keep my resume active and recent. So I said, I had this flash fiction piece that has nothing to do with my novel that I kind of like, and I just want to get it published. And so I pretended like I was a client, and I said, okay, let's shoot for sort of mid-tier accessible journals. And I used my algorithm and I spit out a bunch of journals, and I got the thing published in less than a week. by two journals because a second journal missed my withdrawal email. And so the journal that it got published in is called Bull, B-U-L-L. Nobody's heard of it, but they're kind of a cool journal. And would have I been able to do that if I didn't have my algorithm and my database at my disposal? Absolutely not. I would have done what we all do and like, let's send it out to
everything on Duotrope and see how it goes.
Yeah, exactly. So no, I love the fact that I have it to use. My associate, Christine, I've mentioned her a few times. So we're sort of a two-person show. And she uses it too. She'll send me something and I'll read it. And we kind of edit each other's work from time to time. And she's gotten, I think, 4 stories published in the last year or two.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So we have some clients who've just done wonderful with us. I have one client who I think is up to like 8 or 9 acceptances with us in a couple of years. We another client just started working with us last year and has sent us 5 works, and 4 of them are already published. And the 5th one, you know, fingers crossed. We often get clients who've never been published before, frustrated. I don't know. I'm ready to give up. Help. And I'll often say, let's start with sort of mid-tier accessible journals. Let's get your resume going. And then once you have 3 or 4 publishings, then we can start shooting for higher tier journals, which can be frustrating because then the rejections really start coming in. But I'm doing that with some of my clients too. So, but yeah, to answer your question, yeah, I use it myself for sure.
Well, thank you. This has been a great interview and I will be editing it down quite a bit. And thank you so much.
Yeah, that was a really great interview. Thank you very much. And thank you for empowering writers. This is a very empowering service. So
it's my pleasure and I had a great time. Thank you guys.
Awesome. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
As someone said, they put all these buttons at the bottom and now you can't tell what's what.